They're not going to know what to do next.
Talk Cheese. Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with William Fink, with another installation of Christogenos and our continuing series on the book of Ezekiel. I just want to quickly announce that due to all of the chat room troll problems we've been having, if there's any, I don't want to mute any guests. However, if one of the guests starts acting up and turns out to be either Lynch Stench himself or one of his friends, you know, I'm just going to have to block participation of the guests. And it's been our understanding, or we've found out that typically the non-provocative guests don't really care. They keep listening, but it's those who are those provocateurs who, when they get booted, they come right back, right? So we'll just block all participation if it comes to that point. So I hope you all understand it's a necessary matter under the current circumstances. And Martin Lindstench, who is definitely an agent provocateur, who has come right out of the insane asylum and declared himself to be a Aryan Nations Christian Identity minister and wants to inflict the race war, that he wants to make all white people attack Jews and other people so that we can all die. You know, he's an idiot. He's a complete idiot. So it's obvious that he doesn't know anything about Scripture. And he never says anything about Scripture on any of his posts. And he's got the biggest potty mouth I've ever seen from anyone claiming to be an identity minister, okay? So it's over for him. It's simply over for him. And but if he wants to be a troll, you know, he can probably do that. But, you know, my understanding is his own talk show never had more than two or three guests. And Sword Brethren says that the two of those guests were Lindstedt signed in under another name, right? So in any case, we're good riddance. Good riddance to Martin Lindstench for all his, you know, nastiness and reprobate talk and behavior. Good riddance. Good riddance once and for all. Okay. Chapter 43, Book of Ezekiel. Do you have any comments before, any kind of wrap-up or summary of as the New Jerusalem chapters we just went through?
Well, we're still going through those chapters. It'll be the next six. This whole end part of Ezekiel, it goes into further detail. Uh-huh. Some of it's a little mundane, and we may just give a synopsis of some of it, but this is all prophecies of a temple in the future, and we're going to see that this is definitely in Ezekiel's future and far into the future. From Ezekiel chapters 40 right through the end of the book as we know it. And they were all written at the same time, 572 B.C., the 25th year of Ezekiel's captivity. Ezekiel was taken captive with Jehoiachin. I couldn't remember that name last week. I'm sorry.
Right.
and with 10,000 of the principal men and craftsmen of Judah circa 597 B.C. That's from 2 Kings chapter 24. And we'll see that he is still by the river Kabar in northern Mesopotamia, and has been for 25 years as he wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
Many people seem to think that these following verses are talking about a rebuilt temple, the rebuilt temple from the time of Zerubbabel, and it's not. And
okay.
And rather, this temple vision describes a land inhabited by all 12 tribes, as we shall see in these upcoming chapters. And we know that never happened of Zerubbabel's temple, right?
Mm-hmm.
It never happened of Herod's temple or any temple since the Israelites were deported. And what we will see in this chapter, that Yahweh inhabits this temple in the body of a man, which can only be Christ. But Ezekiel's his perspective is definitely Old Testament sacrifices, rituals, and things like that. And I believe that they're not to be taken literally here. Okay, I believe that although these sacrifices parallel the old Levitical priesthood, Ezekiel simply uses them and to consciously or not to represent the services which our race will perform for Yahweh our God in the future. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at the future and the restoration of Israel through those old covenant eyes. And these chapters absolutely parallel the Revelation, and we'll see further parallels to the Revelation, to the end chapters of the Revelation as we proceed, but they basically parallel the Revelation chapter 21, verses 15 through 22, verses 9 through 22, that discuss the city descended from heaven, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I believe that's a vision of this same thing.
Okay. All right, well, let's get into chapter 43. Afterward, he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looks toward the east, and behold, the glory of the Elohim of Israel came from the way of the east, and his voice was like a noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory.
Now I have a note on this. You know, I believe that this is a symbolic representation of the return of Christ.
Uh-huh, okay.
The glory of Yahweh departing the original temple,
mm-hmm,
was described by Ezekiel in much the same manner, except going the other way, right?
Okay.
Leaping instead of coming,
right.
in Ezekiel chapter 9. Here the prophet sees a vision of his return to this new temple. And yet being a prophetic vision, it is a representation and not necessarily to be taken literally.
Mm-hmm.
It's certain that that Yahweh shall return to dwell with his people as he did in the Old Covenant, right, in the kingdom period, but this time he'll return in the body of a man,
right,
which is Yahshua Christ.
Right. Well, and of course, the east represents the rising sun, and that's just another metaphor for his coming. He will be coming, shining a very great light upon his world.
Exactly.
Yes.
Now, as Ezekiel apparently had no concept of the New Testament paradigm, where with Yahweh in the body of Christ and the body as a vessel for the Spirit of God, which is actually the true temple, right? Ezekiel needed to describe a brick and mortar temple and a spiritual manifestation of Yahweh because that was within his experience. And that is how this vision was given to him.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically the same vision that we see in the last chapters of the Revelation,
right,
where John did have that New Testament concept.
That's right. Okay, verse 3. And it was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when I came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Kibar, and I fell upon the face. Now, of course, we could that city that is being destroyed here could also be that great city, Mystery Babylon, right? So, you know, this can be talking at various different levels. Verse 4. And the glory of Yahweh came into the house by the way of the gate whose prospect is toward the east. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of Yahweh filled the house, and I heard him speaking to me out of the house, and the man stood by me. And I just want to maybe make a quick comment on verse 5 where he says, so the Spirit took me up. And there's many cases in which Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and virtually all of the prophets describe themselves being taken up into heaven to see things, or that the Spirit took over them and that they were inspired by the Spirit to write the words that they were writing, okay?
And even Paul and John.
Yes.
In the Revelation.
Yes.
John saw a door open in heaven, and the angel said to him, come up here.
Uh-huh.
It's very much the same
type of
description.
So this writing is inspired, but not the translations of the King James translators. They never made any claim that they were inspired when they were making these translations, okay?
Well, right. They, even in the Westminster Confession, as you pointed out, and I used in my presentation a couple of weeks ago, said that the original languages had to be appealed to.
That's right. Whenever there's a dispute, exactly. Okay, verse 7. And he said to me, son of man, the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet would where I dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever, and my holy name shall the house of Israel no more defile, neither they nor their kings by their whoredom, nor by the carcasses of their kings in their high places. Of course, this has not happened yet. We're still talking about the ultimate day of reckoning and the wedding feast of the Lamb, when all of this evil is destroyed. Verse 8.
Now, let me just say that this, you know, we might see this as a personification of a spiritual God, but I see this verse 7 as describing Yahweh in the body of a man.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see a reference when we get to the next chapter of a prince who eats bread before the Lord daily. And I believe that that prince is Yahshua Christ.
Uh-huh.
Because he can be the Father and the Spirit and the Son and the body at the same time.
Okay, very good. Verse 8, in their setting of their threshold by my thresholds and their post by my posts and the wall between me and them, they have even defiled my holy name by their abominations that they have committed. Wherefore, I have consumed them in my anger. Well, if the Jews are the people of the book and of the law, why aren't they attempting to make good and turn their way around? Why aren't they doing that? Of course, that's because they're not the Israelites of the Bible. Verse 9, now let them put away their whoredom and the carcasses of their kings far from me, and I will dwell in the midst of them forever.
Now this is really important. Let them put away their whoredom and the carcasses of their kings. Here we have the entire reason for our inevitable punishment and our experience as a people these past 3,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Along with our whoredom, we demanded earthly kings having rejected Yahweh as king. The whole Bible story is that he will be our king, whether we like it or not. We're going to go along with the program.
We will rule with a rod of iron.
But we're ready to put away the carcasses of our kings now. I mean, we've seen all of the destruction and the corruption that have resulted on because our ancestors demanded an earthly king and rejected the Yahweh as king. And it's caused us nothing but trouble for 3,000 years, right?
Right. Okay, so let's see, verse 9. Now let them put away their whoredom and the carcasses of their kings far from me, and I will dwell in the midst of them forever. You, son of man, show the house to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the pattern. I don't think it's likely that the Jews will ever be ashamed of their iniquities. Okay, verse 11. And if they be ashamed of all that they have done, show them the form of the house and the fashion thereof and the goings out thereof and the comings in thereof, that is the daily activities, and all of the forms thereof and all the ordinances thereof and all the forms thereof and the laws thereof, and write it in their sight that they may keep the whole form thereof and all the ordinances thereof and do them. This is the law of the house. Upon the top of the mountain, the whole limit thereof round about shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the house, Lynn Stench. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Let me say that in verse 10, that what follows is symbolic of Israel's cleansing themselves and conforming to the law and the making of atoning sacrifices, which in the New Testament doesn't necessarily mean sacrificial rituals, right?
Mm-hmm.
And an atoning sacrifice would be to love and care for your brethren and to keep the commandments of Christ, because that's what we're told to do.
Right.
And this is all representative of the need to follow his law.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, verse 11 has a conditional clause in it, and if they be ashamed of all they have done, that conditional doesn't exist in the Septuagint.
Okay, interesting. Okay, and let's read it without it. They be ashamed of all that they have done. We should be.
Right. Basically, they will be ashamed of all they have done.
Yes, we will be. There's no doubt. There's no doubt because the especially current events are, you know, either we obey the law or we suffer the punishments of not obeying the law. Okay? Let me repeat verse 12 then, because it is important. This is the law of the house. Upon the top of the mountain, that is the government, the whole limit thereof round about shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the house. And these are the measures of the altar after the cubits. The cubit is a cubit and a hand breadth. Even the bottom shall be a cubit and the breadth of a cubit. And the border thereof of the edges there round about shall be a span. And this shall be the higher place of the altar. And so, let me just scan through these because we're back to cubits and measurements that really we can't really discuss in terms of what they might mean in actual measurement or even prophetically. It's hard to suggest something here. But jumping down to verse 18, and he said to me, Son of man, thus says Yahweh Elohim, these are the ordinances of the altar in the day when they shall make it to offer burnt offerings thereon and to sprinkle blood thereon. And you shall give to the priests, the Levites, that be of the seed of Zadok, which approach to me to minister to me, says the Lord God, a young bullock for a sin offering. Now, last time we discussed briefly Zadok. Was he a descendant of Aaron, or was he?
Well, yes, he was a priest of the temple, right? So he had to be a descendant of Aaron. He was a high priest. Mm-hmm. He was the priest in the days of David that brought the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem when Jerusalem finally became the capital city of Judah. Mm-hmm. And he's mentioned also often, very often, with Nathan the prophet. And it, apparently this Nathan the prophet had a book at one time that's lost to us, right?
Mm-hmm.
He had writings and we don't have them anymore. And also Zadok was the one who anointed Solomon king on David's death. I didn't go back and read the account in 1 Samuel since last week, but it seems to me that this Zadok was especially to merit this mention in Ezekiel, and this is several times in connection with this new temple, he must have been especially pious and favored in the eyes of Yahweh.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Okay, verse 20. And you shall take of the blood thereof and put it on the four horns of it and on the four corners of the settle and upon the border round about. Thus shall you cleanse and purge it. And, of course, last time and throughout many, metaphorical usages of the four corners, the four corners of the world, the four directions, et cetera, et cetera. These are almost always talking about the four major tribes of the house of Israel, okay? And we talked about the symbolism of the lion, the man, the eagle, and what was the other one?
The bull for Ephraim?
The bull for Ephraim.
Is this a Russell Walker mental block you're having?
Yeah, right. Ephraim, I'm prejudiced against Ephraim, right? So we have those four major tribes, Judah, Ephraim, Dan, and I have a mental block on the other one, too.
Reuben, the man.
Reuben is the man, exactly. Thank you. Okay, so verse 21. You shall take the bullock also of the sin offering, and he shall burn it in the appointed place of the house outside the sanctuary. And on the second day you shall offer a kid of the goats without blemish for a sin offering, and they shall cleanse the altar as they did cleanse it with the bullock. When you have made an end of cleansing it, you shall offer a young bullock without blemish and a ram out of the flock without blemish, and you shall offer them before Yahweh, and the priest shall cast salt upon them, and they shall offer them for a burnt offering to Yahweh. 7 days shall you prepare every day a goat for a sin offering. They shall also prepare a young bullock and a ram out of the flock without blemish. Okay, 7 days shall they purge the altar and purify it, and they shall consecrate themselves. And when these days are expired, it shall be that upon the eighth day and so forward, the priest shall make your burnt offerings upon the altar and your peace offerings, and I will accept you, says Yahweh Elohim. So
this all shows a need to follow the law, but it also shows that repentance is necessary and conformance are necessary before acceptance, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the exact opposite that the church teaches. The church teaches that Jesus accepts everybody. The word says that we have to repent and conform to the law before we're accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh doesn't accept sinners.
Yes, yes. Okay, chapter 44, verse 1. Then he brought me back the way of the gate of the outward sanctuary, which looks toward the east, and it was shut. Then said Yahweh to me, this gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, and no man shall enter in by it, because Yahweh, the Elohim of Israel, has entered in by it, therefore it shall be shut. It is for the prince. Now, this could also be a metaphorical reference back to the shutting of the gates of the garden, okay, so that the heaven cannot be taken by storm since we lost our Shekinah glory. We have no right to go back in there, right? And of course, we're talking metaphorically of the spiritual garden. And Yahweh has shut us out from there because we, because our parents, Adam and Eve, sinned. All right, verse 3. It's for the prince he shall sit in it to eat, to eat bread before Yahweh. He shall enter by the way of the porch of that gate and shall go out by the way of the same. Okay?
Now, Ezekiel 43:9 said that we would have no more kings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this prince is a central figure in this new temple vision which Ezekiel has.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's because it has to be Yahshua Christ. It has to be a reference to the Christ dwelling with us.
Right, right, right. And he can dwell with us in the flesh and in the spirit at the same time. So it's not for those people who wonder if he's actually going to come back in the flesh. Well, why not? Okay.
Well, he's in the Book of Acts, and at the end of the Gospel of Luke, it's explicitly stated that he's going to come back.
He'll
in the
come
flesh.
Back the same way that he left. Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. Verse 5. And Yahweh said to me, Son of man, mark well and behold with your eyes and hear with your ears all that I say to you concerning all the ordinances of the house of Yahweh and all the laws thereof, and mark well the entering in of the house with every going forth of the sanctuary to make sure that the no people who aren't supposed to come in do come in. And you shall say to the rebellious, even to the house of Israel, thus says Yahweh Elohim, O you house of Israel, let it suffice you of all your abominations, in that you have brought into my sanctuary strangers, uncircumcised in the heart, and uncircumcised in the flesh. Okay, how many uncircumcised in the heart do we have in Israel today? And, of course, in Judaism, or in Judeo-Christianity.
And there are many instances in Scripture of demands that men circumcise themselves. And even regardless of that, it's the circumcision which comes from Yahweh that matters.
Mm-hmm.
It is he who has chosen us, and non-Israelites cannot choose him.
Right.
And the circumcision that matters is the circumcision of Deuteronomy 36, chapter 30, verse 6, and Yahweh thy God will circumcise thine heart,
mm-hmm.
and the heart of thy seed, to love Yahweh thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, that thou mayest live. And that's the circumcision that matters, right?
Right.
So you could claim to circumcise yourself. If you're not an Israelite, if you haven't received the circumcision from Yahweh and these laws written in our hearts, and we have to be one of the seed, that then you can't come into the sanctuary.
Right. Exactly. And I think recently you and I discussed this, I think, in a different context. Very recently, the signs that were posted on the placards on the corners and in the gates of the temple saying death to any non-Israelites, and the non-Israelites are not allowed here, okay?
Well, right, but the shame of it is that what they did, and those were from the Hellenic period, the Hellenic Greek period, and Greeks weren't allowed into the temple even, but the shame is that they took these Edomites and baptized them and called them Israelites, right?
Right, exactly.
That's the error there.
Right, and then later
they took those strangers who weren't circumcised in the Deuteronomy 36 promise, and they tried to circumcise them.
Right, right. And certainly later, after the Edomites took control of the house of Judah and took control of the temple and of Jerusalem, et cetera, then they started entering, and Josephus talks about it very, very plainly, that Herod, for the first time ever, had allowed Edomites into the temple, okay? None of these Judeo-Christian ministers will ever talk about that episode and the fact that Edomites took over the land. Okay, it's very important in our history to understand this. Okay, let me read verse 7 again, because you know it is our covenant back in Exodus 19:8, I believe, where our ancestors took an oath to obey the law, but have never done so. Right? They immediately built a golden statues right after making that promise. Anyway, verse 7 again. In that you have brought into my sanctuary strangers, uncircumcised in heart and uncircumcised in flesh, to be in my sanctuary to pollute it. We're talking about Edomites and all people that we have converted, which we shouldn't convert. Even my house, when you offer my bread, the fat and the blood, and they have broken my covenant because of all your abominations. And this is verified by Yahshua Christ in the New Testament, Matthew chapter 13, verses 15 through 18, where he says, there are people whom I do not wish to convert. Okay? I will not even preach to them, lest they be converted. Okay? So this is totally consistent between Old Testament and New Testament. Verse 8. And you have not kept the charge of my holy things, but you have set keepers of my charge in my sanctuary for yourselves. Again, we're talking about the priesthood overruling Yahweh, which is a very, very common thing for all priesthoods that are illegitimate. And that would include the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, Judaism, you name it. All of these churches which have established priesthoods not connected to the hereditary house of Israel or house of Judah, these are false churches. They have no right to exist, and they will be destroyed at the end of days. Verse 9, thus says Yahweh Elohim, no stranger uncircumcised in heart nor uncircumcised in flesh shall enter into my sanctuary, and of any stranger that is among the children of Israel. Bill, did you have a chance to look up the Hebrew word that is being used here for stranger? Because sometimes it is ger, but that's usually a stranger of, an unknown person of our own house. And then there's another word, often nokri, which is a non-Israelite stranger, and those are the people who are absolutely forbidden from entering into the sanctuary. Okay? So I don't know if you have a chance to look that up.
Yeah, I'm looking at the King James now.
Right. A stranger in verse 9. And where was the other instance of stranger? Certainly in verse 9.
This actually seems to be saying in Hebrew, no son of the uncircumcised.
Okay, well, when this was written, only the Israelites were circumcised. Certainly the Canaanites weren't. Okay. The Canaanites did not practice circumcision until John Hyrcanus gave him the ultimatum, right, in 121 B.C.,
Even Josephus states that only the Israelites, and what he calls the Phoenicians, who were Israelites, were
right.
circumcised.
Exactly.
Meaning that the people of Tyre.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very good, very good. Okay, verse 10. And the Levites that are gone away far from me, when Israel went astray, which went astray away from me after their idols, they shall even bear their iniquity. So, and the Levites, of course, were at one time a separate tribe. So this can't be blamed on Judah, right? It can only be blamed on the Levites themselves. And, of course, they were not given any land inheritance except for a few cities. So they really did not constitute an official tribe after that decision was made by Yahweh. Verse 11, yet they shall be ministers in my sanctuary, having charge at the gates of the house, whether good or evil, right? Just as the kings were both good and evil, but mostly evil. And ministering to the house, they shall slay the burnt offering and the sacrifice for the people, and they shall stand before them to minister to them. So the vast majority of time, these Levitical priests were officiating properly in their offices. However, most of the time, they were not sincere. They were simply going through the motions.
Well, this seems to me that all of the errant priests will be punished, but once again, they will be made to us. They will, when it all ends, assume their proper duties, and we shall conform to the will of our God one way or another.
Right, right.
And I'm sure that by the time of the end, we'll all more than want to comply, right?
Right, right, right. Okay. All right. Verse 12, because they ministered to them before their idols and caused the house of Israel to fall into iniquity. Therefore have I lifted up my hand against them, says Yahweh Elohim, and they shall bear their iniquity. Okay, we always bear our iniquity. There is no way around this. Verse 13. And they shall not come near to me to do the office of a priest to me, nor to come near to any of my holy things in the most holy place, but they shall bear their shame and their abominations which they have committed. Do you think this verse is prophesying the day when the Levitical priesthood will no longer function?
Well, it shouldn't be functioning now, but this is a...
Right.
I believe that this is a metaphor that the Levitical priests of the past and all the servants of Yahweh of the past who didn't do the right thing, they will do the proper service to God.
Ultimately.
As a restoration.
That's right. That's right. Verse 14. But I will make them keepers of the charge of the house for all that service thereof and for all that shall be done therein. So ultimately this house of Yahweh, which is to come, will have honorable and dutiful priests. Verse 15. But the priests of the Levites, the sons of Zadok, that kept charge of my sanctuary when the children of Israel went astray from me, they shall come near to me to minister to me, and they shall stand before me to offer to me the fat and the blood, says Yahweh. Now, of course, we know that the actual Levitical priesthood no longer offers the fat and the blood.
But these are allegories for the service that we'll perform to our God in the future. And the rest of the chapter of this chapter simply repeats a lot of the old Levitical laws concerning the priests, which to me is only an indication that the laws of Yahweh are forever necessary.
That's right.
For those who are chosen to serve him.
Right.
Because this is talking about the future. And if someone claims to serve Yahweh and respects not his law, then it's obvious that man's a charlatan and a liar.
Right, exactly. Verse 16, they shall enter into my sanctuary, and they shall come near to my table to minister to me, and they shall keep my charge. And it shall come to pass that when they enter in at the gates of the inner court, they shall be clothed with linen garments, and no wool shall come upon them while they minister in the gates of the inner court and within. They shall have linen bonnets upon their heads, and shall have linen breeches upon their loins. They shall not gird themselves with anything that causes sweat. And when they go forth into the outer court, even into the outer court to the people, they shall put off their garments wherein they ministered, and lay them in the holy chambers, and they shall put on other garments, and they shall not sanctify the people with their garments. Neither shall they shave their heads, nor permit their locks to grow long. Is he talking about these rabbis who let their locks grow down the sides of their faces? Nor permit their locks to grow long. They shall only pull their heads, or trim their heads and their beards. Neither shall any priest drink wine when they enter into the inner court. You mean we can drink wine when we're not in the inner court?
Praise
Yahweh, there is a God. Okay, you were going to say?
Well, I said, well, of course.
Oh, of course, yes. Verse 22, neither shall they take for their wives a widow, nor her that is put away, but they shall take maidens of the seed of the house of Israel, or a widow that had a priest before. Okay, there's another racially exclusive statement, folks.
Well, the next one is also racially exclusive.
Verse 23, then. And they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the profane, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean and the unclean. Now, of course, there's a passage, I believe it's in Galatians, where the translators translate, touch not the unclean thing. Okay.
Well, right. It's talking about people. Thing
talking
is not in the text.
Just as these verses are talking about people. But
and in the context in Galatians, it says, come out from among them. mm-hmm. and touch not be unclean. It's definitely
right.
talking about
people. That's right. So they deliberately changed the translation into an inanimate object to fool us into thinking that the discussion is about inanimate objects, when, of course, the discussion is about people, races, that we're not to touch unclean races, right? Verse 24, and in controversy they shall stand in judgment, and they shall judge it according to my judgments, and they shall keep my laws and my statutes in all my assemblies, and they shall hallow my Sabbaths, and they shall come at no dead person to defile themselves. I think some of these people walking around today are zombies. Whether they're actually alive or dead is debatable. But for father, nor for mother, or for son, or for daughter, for brother, or for sister that has no husband, they may defile themselves. Wait a minute. Defile themselves? They may defile. I think this word defile is probably
appropriate. And they shall come at no dead person
right.
to defile themselves.
Right.
If you touch a dead person, you're considered unclean
right.
or defiled. And you can't, going back to read the law in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, you can't enter into the town, into the city.
Mm-hmm.
You can't come back to the congregation
right.
until
right.
you have to stay outside of the congregation for a certain amount of time. When I say the congregation, I mean the people in general, right?
Yes.
You have to stay outside of the encampment for a certain number of days or
okay.
hours and cleanse yourself,
yes.
all right? That now it's saying, but for father or mother or son who dies,
mm-hmm.
you may remove them and
oh,
see
okay.
to their court.
Okay.
You may defile yourself.
Right.
But
okay.
when a family member dies, you have to see to the corpse and take care of them, right?
Right.
That's what this is saying.
Right. Very good. And after he is cleansed, they shall reckon to him 7 days. And in the day that he goes into the sanctuary, to the inner court, to minister in the sanctuary, he shall offer his sin offering, says Yahweh Elohim. And it shall be to them for an inheritance. I am their inheritance. And you shall give them no possession in Israel. I am their possession. This is a pretty close relationship between us and them, correctly, and him. Okay. I'm scrolling to check for trolls. Excuse me a second. Okay. All right, here we are. Where was I? I am their possession. That was verse 28. Verse 29. They shall eat the meat offering and the sin offering and the trespass offering, and every dedicated thing in Israel shall be theirs. And the first of all, the first fruits of all things, and every oblation of all, and every sort of your oblations shall be the priests. You shall also give to the priest the first of your dough, that he may cause the blessing to rest in your house. Okay, one more verse.
Yeah, you might want to squash Brian Rio.
Yeah, it's not the real Brian Rio, is it? Okay. Something's not right there. Okay. Verse 31, the priest shall not eat of anything that is dead of itself or torn, whether it be fowl or beast. Chapter 45, verse 1, moreover, when you shall divide by lot the land for inheritance, you shall offer an oblation to Yahweh, a holy portion of the land. The length shall be the length of the 5 and 20,000 reeds. And the breadth shall be 10,000. This shall be holy, and all the borders thereof round about. Okay, verse 2.
Well, I have a couple of
okay.
comments. But first, chapter 45 demonstrates that this is certainly the quote-unquote new earth or new land spoken of by Peter in his epistle, and that these chapters indeed represent that same thing which Revelation chapter 21 represents. If it wasn't clear from chapters 40 through 44, it should definitely be clear here. That now, the word reeds in 45:1, the length of it shall be 25,000 reeds.
Okay.
The word reeds is added to the text.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Okay? Now the North American Standard Bible adds cubits instead of reeds. In other words, they're both just guessing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even the Septuagint Greek has no unit of measure. It just says the length of it shall be 25,000. even though Brenton added the word reads into his English translation.
Right, right.
Supposing that it should be reads. Now 25,000 of the reads that we saw in Ezekiel chapter 40 would be 49.9 miles.
Okay.
And that's at 10.5 feet per reed, right? Six royal cubits. And 25,000 cubits of that same royal cubit 21 inches would be like 8.31 miles.
Yes.
Okay. So that's a big difference if it's a reed or a cubit. But either way, the breadth being 40% of the length, either way, if this alone is the holy portion of the land, that portion set aside for Yahweh, that then, according to tradition, it would be situated in a very large land,
yes,
which by no means could be Palestine.
Right, right. Yeah,
now, the word cubit does appear in all the texts where we see it in verse 2. It is talking about cubits in verse 2. But here there is no real unit of measure. We don't know if it's reeds or cubits, if it's 50 miles or 8.3 miles, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, earlier, I think it was chapter 43, where we're told that the measurements are, in fact, cubits plus the breadth of a hand. And so that was the difference between a regular cubit and a royal cubit. And as I understand it, for those who don't know anything about cubits, the old world cubit was the measurement from the elbow to the tip of your forefinger plus the breadth of the hand would be the width of your hand added to that. So those are the two different cubits. Now, why they would add this word reed instead of cubit, you know, what gives
them... Well, because there's no word in the Hebrew.
Oh, right.
It says that the length is going to be 25,000.
Why would they choose reeds instead of cubits? Because the
Because reeds, both of them have been used as a unit of measure throughout the book of Ezekiel.
Oh, okay.
You know, throughout the last five chapters.
Okay, so they just
You know, we saw both reeds and cubits used as a unit of measure to describe the temple, the new temple that Ezekiel was seeing. So here, there's no unit of measure given, so the King James translators said, well, maybe it's reeds.
Yeah.
And the NAS translators said, well, maybe it's cubits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know what? And Brenton, when he did the Greek, the people that translated the Septuagint from the Hebrew, they didn't add the unit of measure in. They didn't make a supposition. They left it just as it reads in the Hebrew.
Right.
With neither reeds nor cubits, right?
Yes.
So Brenton supposed it should also be reeds. But the truth is that either one is a supposition.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Either way, it's a supposition. Okay, very good. All right, verse 2, of this there shall be for the sanctuary 500 in length, with 500 in breadth, square round about, and 50 cubits round about for the suburbs thereof. And of this measure shall you measure the length of 25,000. Okay, the holy portion of the land. Let me finish verse 3. And of this measure shall you measure the length of 25,000 and the breadth of 10,000, and in it shall be the sanctuary and the most holy place. The holy portion of the land shall be for the priests, the ministers of the sanctuary, which shall come near to the minister to Yahweh, and it shall be a place for their houses and a holy place for the sanctuary. And the 25,000 of length and the 10,000 of breadth shall also the Levites, the ministers of the house, have for themselves for possession for 20 chambers. Well, I think one thing from Revelation chapter 21, which really recapitulates a lot of this language, is that all 12 tribes will be represented, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes. However, since the Levites don't constitute a separate tribe, then Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, having been adopted by Jacob, now constitute the replacements. Okay, so we're back to 12 tribes. So there definitely are 12 tribes of Israel constituting the 144,000, and the Levites are part of every tribe because they were allowed to take wives from every other tribe. Okay?
Well, if we really look at Revelation chapter 7, right, we'll see that 144,000 are sealed for a specific purpose, but following them, there's an innumerable multitude.
Mm-hmm.
And the innumerable multitude is an innumerable multitude of Israelites.
That's right.
Because it says that the innumerable multitude had washed their garments in the blood of the Lamb, and only Israelites could do that.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's 144,000 plus an innumerable multitude. Now, the 144,000 are mentioned in Revelation chapter 7. And they're mentioned again in Revelation chapter, it's maybe around chapter 16.
Okay.
But I don't think they're mentioned in Revelation chapter 21.
Well, we have the 12 tribes with 12,000 of each tribe. Okay, that's definitely...
Well, that's in Revelation chapter 7.
Okay, well, I don't want to lose my place here, but maybe before the end of the show we can take a quick jump there to Revelation 21. But it does say the 12 tribes of Israel.
In Revelation 21:16, it says the 12 tribes of Israel,
right.
And it says that the city is 12,000 furlongs.
Right, okay.
Okay, but the 144,000, they are not mentioned after Revelation chapter 14.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right, very good. Verse 6, and you shall appoint the possession of the city 5,000 broad and 20,000 long. Now, here they didn't insert any any typical measures. Opposite the oblation of the holy portion, it shall be for the whole house of Israel. A portion shall be for the prince on the one side, and the other side of the oblation for the holy of the holy portion and of the possession of the city, before the oblation of the holy portion and before the possession of the city from the west side westward, from the east side eastward, and the length shall be over against one of the portions. In the land shall be his possession in Israel, and my princes shall no more oppress my people, and the rest of the land shall give to the house of Israel according to their tribes. Okay, here's verse 8 talking about the land will belong to him. Okay, or actually to Israel. And it's been the case that throughout history, only true Israel has developed private property, right? We're the ones who developed the concept of private property because he has given this land to us.
He's ordained the principle of private property.
That's right.
The Jews had sought to abolish that principle in Israel.
That's right.
Ever since, in this modern age, at least since the time of Karl Marx, right?
That's right.
But it's actually a lot longer than that.
That's right.
Now the Aboriginal tribes, they had no real concept. There were other Adamic tribes that had a concept of private property.
Mm-hmm.
The Persians, the Egyptians, they definitely had that concept. But the non-Adamic tribes, I know of nothing in history that ever illustrates that they had that concept.
Yes, yes. Right, and even American Indians, they taught and still teach that they belong to the land, not vice versa. Okay, so this concept of private property comes from the scriptures, and it is exclusive to Christian Israel, because this is scriptural, that we are the dominion people. Verse 9, thus says Yahweh Elohim, let it suffice you, O princes of Israel. Remove violence and spoil and execute judgment and justice. Take away your exactions from my people, that is, your illegal exactions. Verse 10, you shall have just balances. Oh, I can't wait for that day. No fiat money. You will have just balances and a just ephah and a just bath. The ephah and the bath shall be of one measure, that the bath may contain the tenth part of a homer or omer, and the ephah, the tenth part of an omer. The measure thereof shall be after the omer. And the shekel shall be 20 gerahs, 20 shekels, 5 and 20 shekels, 15 shekels shall be your manna.
I believe that this is all, these last verses of this chapter are just illustrating the need for the Old Testament law to ensure that the children of Israel treat each other justly,
right,
and do not take advantage of each other.
Sure, sure.
Because the first thing the enemy does to us, and we do to each other, is to allow the compromising of our money systems.
Right, right. And that's what this is definitely referring to. There shall be no more unjust, and a dollar is not a measure of monetary value. It's a measure of weight. Okay, it's 371.25 grains of silver.
Yes, and that's defined, in, I believe, in the Constitution.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And so if they fluctuate and try to substitute a piece of paper for 371.25 grains of silver, they are violating the Constitution. They're also violating the provisions against fluctuating weights and measures.
Well, they stopped printing United States dollars and started printing Federal Reserve notes,
yes,
and tricked us by continuing to call them dollars, right?
That's right. Exactly. Verse 13. This is the oblation that you shall offer, the sixth part of an ephah of an omer of wheat. You shall give the sixth part of an ephah of an omer of barley. Concerning the ordinance of oil, the bath of oil, you shall offer the tenth part of the bath out of the core, which is an omer of 10 baths, for 10 baths are an omer. And one lamb out of the flock, out of 200, out of the fat pastures of Israel, for a meat offering and for a burnt offering and for the peace offerings, to make reconciliation for them, says Yahweh. All the people of the land shall give this oblation for the prince of Israel. Of course, being the future New Jerusalem, you know, these are metaphors for, you know, we don't have to offer literal lambs anymore. But what we do have to offer is a just weight and measure system that we all offer the same thing. And there should be no, how should I put this, no variation from one person to another. Okay? Verse 17. And it shall be the prince's part to give burnt offerings and meat offerings and drink offerings in the feasts and in the new moons. Of course, that's got to be a bad translation. I'm sure that's... I forget the word now that actually says renewal, Kodesh. I'm sure that word is Kodesh, and the word Kodesh does not mean moon. It means renewal. And in the Sabbaths, in all the solemnities of the house of Israel, he shall prepare the sin offering and the meat offering and the burnt offering and the peace offerings to make reconciliation for the house of Israel. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, in the first month, in the first day of the month, you shall take a young bullock without blemish and cleanse the sanctuary. And the priest shall take of the blood of the sin offering and put it upon the posts of the house and upon the four corners of the settle of the altar, which probably means, what, the threshold or something like that, and upon the posts of the gate of the inner court. And so you shall do the seventh day of the month for everyone that errs, and for him that is simple, so shall you reconcile the house. In the first month of the 14th day of the month, you shall have Passover, a feast of 7 days. Unleavened bread shall be eaten, and upon that day shall the prince prepare for himself and for all the people of the land a bullock for a sin offering. And 7 days of the feast he shall prepare burnt offering to Yahweh, 7 bullocks and 7 rams without blemish, daily the 7 days, and the kid of the goats daily for a sin offering. And we've seen this without blemish, without blemish, without blemish so often. It can only mean one thing, one of unmixed blood, right? What else could it mean? You can't have a goat without blemish if it's a mixed offspring. Only the unmixed offspring can be without blemish. Verse 24. And he shall prepare a meat offering of an ephah for a bullock, and an ephah for a ram, and a hin of oil for an ephah. In the seventh month, in the 15th day of the month, shall he do the like in the feast of the 7 days, according to the sin offering, according to the burnt offering, and according to the meat offering, and according to the oil. Okay, any...
Now, that word was Kodesh. I know you have a dispute with the translation of it, but it was Kodesh.
Right. Okay,
and
thank you.
And you were correct about that. That the, you know, we're talking about the Sabbaths in this chapter coming up and the importance of the Sabbaths and the feasts. And I would still contend that these things indicate the service of our race to God in a language familiar to Ezekiel in the future. And the sacrifices here are not literal, but they're in a language that Ezekiel understands,
right,
when talking about service to God and the ritual sacrifices are what he knew, right?
Right.
But Paul said that the Sabbaths and the feasts were also a shadow of the things which are to come. And we see their importance also illustrated in this next chapter.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right, chapter 46. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, the gate of the inner court that looks toward the east shall be shut the 6 working days, but on the Sabbath it shall be opened, and in the day of the Kodesh it shall be opened, and the prince shall enter by the way of the porch of that gate outside, and shall stand by the post of the gate, and the priest shall prepare his burnt offering and his peace offerings, and he shall worship at the threshold of the gate when he shall go forth. But the gate shall not be shut until the evening. Likewise, the people of the land shall worship at the door of this gate before Yahweh in the Sabbaths and in the Kodeshes. And the burnt offerings that the prince shall offer to Yahweh in the Sabbath day shall be 6 lambs without blemish and a ram without blemish. And, because Paul says that ultimately we are to offer ourselves as sacrifices to Yahweh, and without blemish here means with sinless. Okay? The metaphorical meaning is obviously sinless. Verse 5.
And you can't be of mixed races and be sinless. Sin is error, and error is,
right.
is violating Yahweh's law of kind after kind.
That's right. That's right. Very good. Verse 5. And the meat offering shall be an ephah for a ram, and the meat offering for the lambs as he shall be able to give, and a hin of oil to an ephah. And in the day of the Kodesh it shall be a young bullock without blemish, and 6 lambs and a ram, they shall be without blemish. And he shall prepare a meat offering, an ephah for a bullock, and an ephah for a ram, and for the lambs according as his hand shall attain to, and a hin of oil to an ephah. And when the prince shall enter, he shall go in by the way of the porch of the gate, and he shall go forth by the way thereof. But when the people of the land shall come before Yahweh in the solemn feasts, he that enters in by the way of the north gate to worship shall go out by the way of the south gate, and he that enters by the way of the south gate shall go forth by the way of the north gate. He shall not return by the way of the gate whereby he came in, but shall go forth opposite. And the prince in the midst of them, when they go in, shall go in, and when they go forth, they shall go forth. And in the feasts and in the solemnities, the meat offering shall be an ephah to a bullock, an ephah to a ram, and the lambs he is able to give, and a hin of oil, etc. Okay, so we're talking here more, I think I'm going to skim over, because these are more of the same. Very specific ordinances of particular offerings, okay?
Well, it's pretty mundane.
Yeah, it's pretty mundane, so I don't really think we need to go through this. Let me skim down here.
I have no notes until 47.2.
Okay. I think verse 17, however, let me go to verse 16. Thus says Yahweh, if the prince give a gift to any of his sons, the inheritance thereof shall be his sons. It shall be their possession by inheritance. Of course, this is the law of Yahweh, inheritance. And as you mentioned earlier, the Jews are trying to do away with inheritance. They're always taxing. They're always creating inheritance taxes.
It's 55% right now. It's absolutely.
Wow.
That is just stealing. As of right now, it's zero. Sorry. As of January 1st, it's 55%.
Uh-huh.
And that is outright theft. That's outright Marxism.
Right. And it's more proof that the Jews aren't Israelites because they do not obey the law of inheritance. They're always trying to get rid of it. Okay.
I think on estates valued over $1 million, it's 55%.
Wow.
But if you have a farm valued at $2 million that your family's had since your great-great-grandparents,
mm-hmm.
right, it's very plausible that you could have a $2 million farm and make enough money to pay your real estate taxes, and most states' farm taxes are generally low.
Right.
And your farm is a business, and you might make $100,000 a year, and not have a lot of cash,
right.
but still have a very fluid business. Now, when you go to leave your son that farm, because it's valued over $1 million, he has to pay a 55% inheritance tax on the value of the farm over $1 million. That's $550,000.
Mm-hmm.
Where's he going to get that from? He's going to have to mortgage that farm?
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's stealing.
Of course it is. Yes. Okay, I have to mute somebody here. Okay. Verse 17. But if he give a gift of his inheritance to one of his servants, then it shall be his to the year of liberty, after it shall return to the prince. but his inheritance shall be his son's flesh. And this is talking about the, well, it could be talking about two various jubilees. We have the seven-year year of liberty, and then we have the jubilee itself, which, of course, the Jews have never practiced. So here is another instance in where the Jews failed to obey Yahweh's laws, yet they claim to be his people. And so many Judeo-Christians give them the credit for being, what's the term? Not the overlords, but the lords of the Old Testament, okay? The procurators of the Old Testament. And there are no such thing. They never practiced the law of Moses. And Jesus said to them, if ye had believed Moses, you would believe me. He said right to their faces. They're not believers in the law of Moses. And that's, of course, true today.
Well, when the Jews want to destroy something and they can't destroy it head on,
yeah,
they embrace it.
Right, right.
But when they want to destroy the Word of God, they've
yeah.
embraced it as their own.
Right.
When they want to destroy Christ, they embrace him as a Jew.
Right.
But when they want to
exactly.
destroy Christian identity, that like Martin Lynch, that they claim to be Christian identity.
That's right. That's right. Well, yeah, Schopenhauer put it best. You know, how do the Jews go about destroying the Schopenhauer philosophy? They
by creating
a Schopenhauer group, right? And they pour more money into it than the rest of us have, and pretty soon everybody thinks that Schopenhauer is a Jew lover, right? That's what they did to Christianity. Verse 18, moreover, the prince shall not take of the people's inheritance by oppression. Wow. Does this apply to our government or what? To thrust them out of their possession? How many people are being thrust out of their homes by our illegal government, folks? But he shall give his son's inheritance out of his own possession, that my people be not scattered, every man from his possession. So we can see that property taxes are absolutely illegal.
Absolutely. They're unlawful, yes.
And I don't think they're allowed by our Constitution either.
Inheritance taxes on the land are unlawful, and property taxes are unlawful, and the English common law never, ever allowed a creditor to take a man's land.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Jews moved in with their shitar and got the kings to accept the shitar as the commercial law of the land, that allowed for the mortgage.
Yes. Right.
And that made, basically allowed the mortgage to be issued and to separate a man from his land for debt,
mm-hmm.
where that could never happen before that time.
Right.
In English common law. It's odious to God to remove a man from his land.
Yes.
For debt.
Yes.
They could take everything else under the English common law. I mean, if you ran up debts, you weren't absolved of them. They'd come and take your cattle and your pigs and whatever else you had, but they couldn't take your land.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And it should, it's going to be that way again. And our people are being dispossessed not only of their property, their land, their homes, their cars, but their lifestyle and our heritage.
Well, under the Old Testament law, you couldn't even sell your land.
Right.
Yeah, you could, I mean, I guess you could purposely forget to redeem it,
mm-hmm.
but you couldn't, at the 50-year Jubilee, it had to be returned to you.
Right, well, yeah.
Because it really didn't even belong to you. It really belonged to your lineage.
That's right, yeah. I was just getting ready to say, if you don't repossess it, one of your relatives could.
Right,
okay.
Well, that's who, it really belongs to your tribe, to your lineage.
Right, exactly.
But if you sold me your land at the 50-year Jubilee, I have to give it back to you.
You have to give it back, right.
So I would pay, if the Jubilee was last year, I would pay you a lot more for your land than if the Jubilee was next year.
Right. Right.
Yeah, because it's really like a lease. There's no permanent removal of a man from his land in Israel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Verse 19. After he brought me through the entry which was at the side of the gate into the holy chambers of the priests which looked toward the north, and behold, there was a place on the two sides westward, he said to me, this is the place where the priest shall boil a trespass offering and a sin offering when they shall bake the meat offering, that they bear them not out into the outer court, or utter court in this case, to sanctify the people. Okay, more talk about four corners and various measures. And verse 24, last verse of chapter 46, Then said he to me, these are the places of them that boil, where the ministers of the house shall boil the sacrifice of the people. So we're going to have, obviously, a variegated society, just as we do now with people fulfilling different functions, but everything will be running smoothly and according to Yahweh's laws, okay? Very unlike we've had since the fall in the garden. Chapter 47, verse 1. Afterward, he brought me again to the door of the house, and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward, for the forefront of the house stood toward the east, and the waters came down from under the right side of the house. And here we go with more directions and lines and measures, etc., and waters.
Well, right, but this is important because, you know, for the last 2 weeks I've been saying that Ezekiel 40 parallels and through 48 parallels Revelation chapter 21, right?
Okay.
And the city from God and the new land, the new heavens, the new earth, all of that is the same. It's talking about the same thing that this is talking about.
Okay.
And here we have these waters coming out from under the threshold, and this symbology is exactly like we find in Revelation chapter 22, verses 1 and 2,
mm-hmm.
where it says, and he showed me a pure river of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb,
midst
of the street and on either side of the river. And there was the tree of life which bare 12 manner of fruits. Now, I believe that's 12 fruits, one for each of the 12 tribes, right?
Right.
And yielded her fruit every month,
right.
And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the fruits are the nations, the nations of Israel, right?
Right.
And this is the same, the water proceeding from the house of God, the water proceeding from the throne of God, that's our race. That's the
mm-hmm.
river of life.
That's right. The river of life, exactly. Exactly. Let me jump to verse 5. Afterward he measured 1,000, it was a river that I could not pass over, for the waters were risen, waters to swim in, and a river that could not be passed over. So, in other words, a torrent of Israelites here. Verse 6, and he said to me, son of man, have you seen this? Then he brought me and caused me to return to the brink of the river. Now when I had returned, behold, at the bank of the river were very many trees on the one side and on the other. And trees are people too, right? Okay. Verse 8, then said he to me, these waters issue out toward the east country and go down into the desert and go into the sea, which were being brought forth into the sea. The waters shall be healed. Praise Yahweh. We need to be healed. And it shall come to pass that everything that lives, which moves wherever the rivers shall come, shall live. And there shall be a very great multitude of fish, because these waters shall come there, for they shall be healed. And everything shall live where the river comes. So we will have an abundance of food, abundance of graces, abundance of offspring, and a peaceful, prosperous society. Verse 10. And it shall come to pass that the fishers shall stand upon it from the En-Gedi, even to the En-Gallim, En-Eglaim, and they shall be a place to spread forth nets. Their fish shall be according to their kinds, as the fish of the great sea, exceeding many. But the Myri, of course, we're going to have a great development of creative inventions, okay, as the white race has always done throughout history. Verse 11, but the Myri places thereof and the marshes thereof shall not be healed. They shall be given to salt, okay?
And I think that means the rivers of the other races.
Okay, yeah, certainly the mixed races, yes.
The miry places and the marshes, that's where the salt water and the fresh water meet, right?
Right, yes, yes. And by the river upon the bank thereof, on this side and on that side, shall grow all trees for meat, whose leaf shall not fade, neither shall the fruit thereof be consumed. It shall bring forth new fruit according to its months, because their waters, they issue out of the sanctuary. And the fruit thereof shall be for meat, and the leaf thereof for medicine. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, this shall be the border whereby you shall inherit the land according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Joseph shall have two portions. And we talked about that already. Verse 14, and you shall inherit it, one as well as another, concerning the which I lifted up my hand to give it to your fathers, and this land shall fall to you for inheritance. There's that word, inheritance again. And this shall be the border of the hand toward the north side, the way of Heslon, as men go to Zedad, between these various borders. Okay, so Ezekiel is seeing, he's describing this new Jerusalem in terms that he can understand.
Yes.
But obviously it's not ancient Palestine. We're not, certainly not talking about ancient Palestine.
Oh, evidently not. It's totally evident.
And so you shall divide this land to you according to the tribes of Israel. And, of course, it can't be talking about the past either, because this has already literally happened. And, of course, we have, I think, not just in Joshua, but in Deuteronomy and several places where it says that wherever we Israelites set our feet, that land belongs to us, verse 22. And it shall come to pass that you shall divide it by lot for an inheritance to you, and to the stranger that sojourn among you, which shall father children among you, and they shall be to you as born in the country among the children of Israel. They shall have inheritance with you among the tribes of Israel. So I would say that this word stranger here has to be translated from the word ger.
Well, it is ger.
It is.
And you know, Yahshua tells us that the other branches of the Adamic race will be in the resurrection.
Right.
Luke chapter 11, and it's also in Matthew, that the men of Nineveh will rise in the resurrection and condemn this race, meaning the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And the men of Nineveh were Shemites, and they were descendants of Asher, the brother of Arphaxad, the father of the, you know, the grandfather of Abraham.
Right, right. Yes, so definitely.
Yes. The first promise of salvation to the Adamic race is in Genesis 3:23.
Okay. And this is metaphorically a very similar promise, no doubt about it. Let me read it again. And it shall come to pass that you shall divide it by lot for an inheritance to you and to the ger that sojourn among you, that is, strangers of our own race.
And it should be translated guest friend, right?
Okay.
A guest friend is what a geyer is.
Okay.
It's someone who comes into your land with an expectation of certain rights and privileges.
Of hospitality.
Yes. That's what the word xenos meant in Greek, and that's what the word geyer, G-E-Y-R, means in Hebrew.
Okay.
And it's Strong's number 1616.
Okay. Very good. Which shall father children among you, and they shall be to you as born in the country among the children of Israel. They shall have inheritance with you among the tribes of Israel. So we're not talking about strangers of another race. We're talking about Adamic strangers. Okay, verse 23. And it shall come to pass that in what tribe the stranger sojourns, there shall you give him his inheritance, says Yahweh Elohim. In other words, there's going to be plenty to go around. Chapter 48. We have a little less than 15 minutes. I don't know if we can get through it. Maybe we'll just try to get through this, and we'll finish Ezekiel tonight. Now, these are the names of the tribes. Okay, so again, we're talking about the various tribes. Well, let's see, because somebody in the chat room brought up the difference in there's a listing of the 12 tribes in Revelation, which leaves Dan out. But this first one is Dan, verse 2.
Well, when we cover the book of Revelation, I'm prepared to discuss that at length.
Okay.
That's referring to a specific historical event that's in our past, the sealing of the 144,000.
Yeah.
That happened before the end of the second woe.
Uh-huh.
It happened before the Reformation.
Right.
It happened before the Turkish invasions of Europe.
Right.
And we'll see that when we discuss the Revelation.
Yeah.
But Dan simply wasn't there.
He wasn't
Dan
there.
Didn't need to be sealed.
Right.
Dan, the biggest part of the tribe of Dan, was already inhabiting land well outside of the theater of operations of the visions in Revelations chapters 4, 5,
and
6.
And definitely outside the theater of the Roman Catholic Church. Okay.
Well, right. Yeah. And Revelation chapters 4, 5, and 6 describe the fall of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan had already more or less been inhabiting Northern Europe for the great part. Dan didn't.
Sweden, Denmark, Finland, the north parts, right? Yes, and also parts of Britain and Ireland. The Danites definitely got that far away. And those portions of the geography were not controlled by the Roman Empire. Okay.
Right.
Yes. Okay. All right. So then it talks about Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Ephraim, Reuben, Judah, for all you Joseph Scepter advocates. Judah is definitely mentioned here, and et cetera, et cetera. All 12 tribes, with, of course, Levi not mentioned because Levi was absorbed into the other 12 tribes, okay? Verse 9, the oblation, and let's talk about the priests here. Verse 10, and for them, even for the priests, shall be this holy oblation toward the north, 5 and 20,000 in length. In other words, the priests will have their territory. Even the Levites were given cities, although they weren't given land tracts. They were just given cities to operate in. Verse 11, it shall be for the priests that are sanctified of the sons of Zadok, which have kept my charge, which went not astray with the children of Israel went astray, when the children of Israel went astray, as the Levites went astray. So it's only going to be talking, we're only talking about good priests. We're not talking about evil priests. Okay, so we have another troll I have to get rid of. Sorry for the interruptions, folks, but we have another troll, okay? And on the verse 12, and this oblation of the land that is offered shall be to them a thing most holy by the border of the Levites. Continuing with the Levites, and opposite the border of the priests, the Levites shall have 5 and 20,000 in length and 10,000 in breadth. All the length shall be 5 and 20,000 and the breadth 10,000. And they shall not sell it. They shall not sell. You just mentioned that earlier. Okay. Neither exchange nor alienate the first fruits of the land, for it is holy to Yahweh. Okay, more numbers in verse 15. More measures. Verse 17, and the suburbs of the city shall be toward the north, 250. Again, describing the suburbs of the great city. Our holy mountain we're going to have, you know, like Washington, D.C. now, which was for a little while a holy place, right? There was honest government there for a while, not for very long, but for a while. But we will have a seat of government which cannot be perverted, okay? Verse 19, and they that serve the city shall serve it out of all the tribes of Israel, okay? So again, it's very exclusive to Israel. Verses 21 are talking again about the measurements and the oblations. Let me quote verse 22. Moreover, from the possession of the Levites and from the possession of the city, being in the midst of that, which is the princes between the border of Judah and the border of Benjamin, shall be for the prince. Of course, there's going to be a focal point, a central house of government. It's going to have a religious area. It's going to have an administrative area. And it's going to have an executive area, just like the American Constitution prescribes, right? Okay. Okay, so the various tribes, Benjamin, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun, Gad, will all have portions.
One of the most important, two important points, because some people are making up prophecies in the chat room.
Okay.
Dan is here, right? We see the tribe of Dan here.
Well,
right?
Yeah, all 12
the tribe of Dan
are
is
America.
Not cursed. Cursed, as some people claim.
No, they're not.
And also, even more importantly, to address some heresies, we see the tribe of Judah is here, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we see Dan and Judah are
right.
here amongst
yes.
the 12 tribes.
Yeah. Now, that idea that Dan was cursed was simply an assumption by various Bible scholars who had no other explanation for it, okay? But what we're the idea that we're discussing tonight, I first came across in Howard B. Rand's study in Revelation, and he studied the historical time and showed, as you just mentioned, just before the end of the second woe, was it in the book of Revelation?
Yes.
But it was part of the Danites being the lead tribe in terms of being in ships going up the rivers of Europe and going far north and far west. They were so far north and so far west that they were out of reach of the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire had no control over them. And that's really what that verse is talking about. I forget what verse, but somebody referenced it in the chat room, okay? Gad is mentioned. Let's see. Okay, verse 29. This is the land which you shall divide by lot to the tribes of Israel for inheritance, and these are their portions. Again, by lot, and again for those Joseph Scepter advocates, Yahweh did not punish Judah by giving it, you know, that land near Edom. It was decided by lot, okay? And the same thing will be happening here in verse 29. And these are the goings out of the city on the north side, 4,500 measures. And the gates of the city shall be after the names of the tribes of Israel. Three gates southward. Again, this parallels Book of Revelation. One gate of Reuben, one gate of Judah, one gate of Levi. And also Book of, I think it's in Numbers, isn't it, where we're talking at this this imagery is first given. This is the order of the encampment of the Israelites as they wandered through the desert, okay?
Well, with slight variation, because Levi wasn't, you know, Levi was in the center of that encampment.
Right, he was in the center, yes. And at the east side, 4,503 gates and one gate of Joseph, one gate of Benjamin, one gate of Dan. So instead of having Ephraim and Manasseh, so this is kind of a reference back before the time that Joseph had a double portion in Ephraim and Manasseh. And the south side, 4,500 measures and three gates, one of Simeon, one of Issachar, one gate of Zebulun, and the west side, 4,500 with their three gates, one of Gad, Asher, Naphtali. It was round about 18,000 measures, and the name of the city from that day shall be Yahweh is there. Okay. All right, so we have so much information here that, you know, that absolutely proves that all of these prophecies are simply about the inheritance of the 12 tribes of Israel and nobody else. That's simple.
Well, exactly. It's the Bible doesn't care about anybody else.
Yeah, it really
I mean, the other Adamic races are in the periphery all the time. The other Adamic Genesis 10 families. They're all white. They're a part of our race. We're not to despise them. Today, they're not identifiable.
Right.
That, you know, there's probably some among us, but and there's I'm sure that we're all like in some part descended from a Persian, an Assyrian, a Syrian or Aramean, right? Or another branch, an Ionian Greek, whatever. But where they are all white people, they just simply weren't the chosen line. They are always in the periphery of Scripture. But the focal point of Scripture is always on the children of Israel. And no, by no means at all can you ever apply it to any of the other races. That's just a total blasphemy.
That's right. It is. It is. There's simply no doubt about that. And the New Testament doesn't teach that the other races can be brought into the covenants or the inheritance or the promises.
No, the New Testament is just as exclusive.
That's right.
And the Revelation is more exclusive than Ezekiel.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, it's the book of Revelation is, again, you have to, certainly in the last chapters where it identifies the 12 tribes of Israel, but even the lampstand. What are the two images? The lampstand and the olive trees. Okay, and those are references to Israel.
Yeah, they're all Israel.
House of Israel. Two lampstands.
Here we see the temple of God, and it has on the gates the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. And in John, and in the Revelation chapter 21, we see the city of God descend from heaven, and the names on its gates are the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. If your patronymical image, if your patronymical lineage isn't from one of those 12 tribes of Israel, or if it is but you're mixed, you're not getting into one of those gates.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You aren't.
There's no room for you in one of those gates. You're just not getting in.
Right. Yeah, not getting in. Very good. Okay, well, I'm surprised we actually got through all this, but you know, we had to jump past a lot of these measurements and these oblations and things, because it's very redundant material, and it's hard to give any specific metaphorical analysis of all that, right? I would say in general it simply means that the
I believe that its repetitiveness stresses very much so the degree to which we require the law mm-hmm. in order to have a successful civilization.
Yes, very good, very good. Yeah, and Yahweh himself has measured all these things out for them, and for us, okay? So we have to keep that in mind, that the, he even says that every hair of our head is measured for us, right? So he does all this measuring for us, and he presents those places for us to inhabit, and that's what we're supposed to do. The invisible hand of Yahweh is moving us and guiding us through history, and eventually this movement is going to become a steamroller, and all the trolls with all the Jews and all the antichrists and all even all the Judeo-Christians who are standing in the way of Yahweh's purpose in establishing his people, the 12 tribes of Israel, as the government of this planet, will simply they will be destroyed. I mean, the scripture says this over and over and over. So we have no intention of denying what the scriptures say. Okay? All right. I think that fairly concludes the book of Ezekiel. Do you have any comments before we close?
Well, no. I'm done with Ezekiel.
Yes. Yes.
With Ezekiel after 16 weeks. Nah, I really enjoyed doing it.
Oh yeah.
And it was fulfilling and it's done and
yes.
Let's move on.
Yeah, and then there's times when you have to read the scriptures carefully, because most of the time when we're reading on our own, you know, let's say before going to bed, or you know, you take a break and read some scripture, we tend to gloss over it and not really pay attention to the language carefully. And there are many, many places where you have to pay very careful attention to the text to understand it, okay? And you have to have some historical knowledge. And certainly the book of Ezekiel requires very close attention, a lot of historical knowledge, and a lot of prophetic knowledge as well in order to comprehend what's being said here.
And every time I read it's I make new notes.
That's right.
With all of the books of the Bible.
Right.
Every time I read a Greek chapter, I make new notes. It never fails.
That's right. There's so much information there. And, yeah, new things always pop out when you read it another time, right? All right. William, thank you very much for joining me in this series. Where are we going next?
Jeremiah. Well, I'm taking next weekend off.
Oh, that's right. Next weekend off.
And then when I come back, we'll start Jeremiah.
We'll start Jeremiah.
But next weekend, you don't have to deal with me.
Right. Okay, very good. Thanks for your participation in this series. Thank you all for listening. Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.